I'm Faith Middleton in New Haven, and this show is about the richness of life. It's the Book Show, a live call-in. Great reads coming your way in this hour. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Let us know about a book you liked. Book Club members, what are you reading? 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. Tell us on Facebook now. Search the Faith Middleton Show or tweet us at FaithWNPR. My book buddies are here. Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut. We have Lee Jacobus, editor of the college textbook A World of Ideas, and Rose Quiello, professor at Southern Connecticut State University and Quinnipiac University. Roxanne.
I would like to talk about a book called Little Failure by Gary Steingart. So Gary Steingart is a young man, I think he's late 30s, early 40s, who was one of these, you know, New Yorker 40 under 40. He's written every book, every novel he's published has shown up on a list for one of the 10 best novels of the year. He's now written a memoir called Little Failure, which is what his father used to call him, and his mother used to call him Snotty or something. Anyway, he is one of the funniest writers you could possibly read. He so he emigrated from Russia when he was 9 or 10 years old. So the book has a combination of elements to it. One is Russia at a time that was, you know, totally falling apart. But the way he describes it is both charmed by its history. He lived in St. Petersburg or Leningrad, and dismissive of its deterioration. It's then about the immigrant experience of coming to this country. And then it's got this David Sedaris quality of being self-deprecating in a way that feels authentic. And then it's about becoming a writer and making a decision to become a writer when your parents think that that's the most absurd sort of profession you could ever have. I am charmed by this book. I love everything this guy's ever written. And so the name of it is Little Failure, and it's Gary Steingart.
Ah, wonderful. Okay. Rose Quiello.
Faith, I've been thinking a lot about, with the new year, books that have changed me. And that's kind of my theme today, books that have changed me. And I couldn't wait to talk about Sarah Bakewell's book, The Life of Montaigne. And the title is How to Live. And what I didn't realize was that Montaigne was the first person, and Lee, I'm sure you know this, to start the genre of essays, the idea of chronicling perceptions in a way that so that the rest of us can look at writing and see ourselves in the mirror. I thought that that might have existed from the beginning of writing, but it hadn't. He's a one-man literary revolution. He started the genre of essays. And I also didn't know that essay in French means to try. And that's just what he does. He puts forth all these perceptions, these essays of smells, of cruelty, some more, some benign, why he prefers melon to other fruits and why he prefers sex lying down rather than standing, which is hilarious. And then he talks about other things like how to deal with bullying. What do you do when somebody is teaching your child something you don't agree with? How to deal with the loss of a loved one. He lost 5 children out of 6 to the plague. And so Virginia Woolf, she said that reading Montaigne is like going into a museum, going up to the portrait, looking at it so deeply and seeing your own reflection in the mirror. And he's my new best friend, Montaigne.
And that's great, right?
I just couldn't wait to talk about it. It's How to Live or A Life of Montaigne by Sarah Bakewell. Fabulous.
Wow. So I was thinking, you made me think of John Ruskin's quote, which is, all books are divisible into 2 classes, the books of the hour and the books of all time. So I think that's what you're getting at.
He was the original blogger. Really, if you think
in a way, you're
if you read these essays, you know, this is like blogging at its most brilliant. I mean, Samuel Pepys's diaries would probably be, he would have been a great blogger.
Yeah, true.
So, well, he really was a blogger, you know, by comparison.
203-776-WNPR, tell us about a book that you have loved, whether it is new or a classic. And book club members, we're also interested in hearing from you about what you have read, so call and tell us. That's how we spread the word about a great read for everybody, 203-776-9677. And when you think about the work that goes into a book, oh, these authors deserve having all of us find out that they've done something terrific. Lee Jacobus.
I wasn't going to talk about this, but you've just raised the issue. I am reading Montaigne's complete essays very, very slowly. It's a huge book, as you probably know. And it is one of the most important books of the Renaissance. I happened also to be extremely influenced in my life by the whole concept of writing essays. Francis Bacon, for example, wrote his own volume of English essays and in imitation of Montaigne in 1605. I have an edition, actually, of that. And it's really – when I was a child, when I was in high school, I read Francis Bacon's essays, and they actually transformed me in a way that you described. You know what book changed your life? That book, his essays, changed my life profoundly.
Why?
And moved
Why,
me.
Lee?
Well, because it awakened me to the way in which the mind works. One of the things that he talked about was the impediments to clear thinking, being part of a tradition that you accept without any questioning, being influenced by other people's opinions, things like that. This is one of his essays is really about the whole method by which you think and think clearly. That just transformed me as a senior in high school. I just became a different person, and it made me really see and look at things in a way that I hadn't done before. Now I'm rereading Montaigne, and one of his great essays is The Apology of Raymond Sebond, in which he examines the customs of people in all areas. For example, the question of whether to believe in God in one version or in another version, to accept this religion, that religion, or another religion. And he finally comes down to the point of saying, look, we can't be sure of anything. So let's go, and if we're in a given environment, we'll accept what those views are and the culture and the habits of that particular community, because we don't know any better. We have no authority to be someone who can say, no, all of that's wrong. We must accept it as it is. It's a very interesting way to go about things, different from, of course, Francis Bacon, but nonetheless a kind of rational way of dealing with it. So let me say, I have been reading Montaigne's essays, translated by Donald Frame. It's a brilliant book, and it's a standard edition, of course, in English. And it's loaded. It's got wonderful stuff.
Thank you, Lee. Sue, Faith Middleton and the gang here on the book show. Go ahead, Sue.
Hi, Faith.
Hi.
I just finished reading Dave Eggers' The Circle.
Oh, yeah.
My gosh.
You loved it, huh?
I loved it. I love Dave Eggers anyway, but it just describes a society that we're getting very close to, where people feel that they have the right to know everything there is to know and document every possible aspect of their lives. And it just left me feeling like if we ever see Google merge with Facebook and Twitter,
we're finished. If that okay. Thank you so much, Sue.
All
the
right,
Circle, Dave Eggers. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I want to recommend a book. I'm almost finished with it, and it's Colm Tobin's book called Brooklyn. And this is the story of it starts out with a family in a small village in Ireland, and one of the members of the family, the less attractive, less accomplished daughter, is sent really to America, and they don't have very much money in Ireland, and she knows that as she leaves, her sister will be probably destined now to care for her mother, and so her life will never change, and her mother will grow old, and who knows if she'll ever see them again. And the reason I'm just giving this little bit of background is to say this. I don't think I've ever read a book that has put me more in touch with that immigrant experience. There's something so intimate and personal where I just, it has my heart. I mean, I just think, oh, I'm with her every minute. She's coming on the boat and what it feels like to come to a new place. And then how it washes over her finally that she is alone in this place. That moment where she says, I have no one, and I'm probably never going to see my loved ones again. I have no one. Mm-hmm. And yet trying to keep that from them back home so that they won't feel upset. Oh, I'm just so taken.
He's so talented. He has a new book coming out that I'm looking – I don't have the galley yet to read it. That I just think he's a genius. And if you look at his range of writing
– Oh, yeah.
He wrote a book on fathers. I mean, he just – his observations about the human experience are extraordinary. You know, he wrote that Testament of Mary, which was so controversial and fascinating.
Yeah,
you know,
it was a play. And I was just given my girlfriend gave me the Master – said, this is the greatest of his books. She said, if you like Brooklyn, wait until you read The Master. Yeah. That's next on my list.
No, she's right. The Master is a masterpiece. It's a really brilliant approach to the whole concept of writing. Writing from the point of view of Henry James. Yeah. I mean, this is astonishing, and he pulls it off. It is truly a brilliant book.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait. So, Colm Tobin, and the name of the novel is Brooklyn. 203-776-9677 is our number. That's 203-776-WNPR, just so people can remember it. Roxanne Cody.
So this is a book I just started, and it's called Master the Art of Quitting. So this is the opposite. For one, this is not a quick little new way. Well, it is quick, but it's not a pop psychology book so much. But it's about, as Americans, our spirit is you persevere. So this is about studies that have been done about when should you quit work? When should you quit a marriage? When should you quit thinking your dream will come true? Because what it ends up doing, ironically, is inhibiting you. So you know how you hear the idea of, you know, feet on the ground, head in the clouds, follow your dreams, never give up. So that's a theory. And I think a theory that has some validity. This is the Hyde to that Jekyll of this is, you know what? Cut your losses.
Yeah.
Why do you think you're holding on to that?
Roxanne, I cannot believe you had chosen this book because I just grabbed this to interview the author.
You're kidding.
To do a whole call-in on this because I thought this is a very interesting idea. It would be a great call-in show.
Don't you think?
I'm so glad you're talking about it.
Yeah, and I like the way it's two people, Peg Streep and Alan Bernstein, and they're social. Alan is a social worker, so it's not just, you know, swooping in. He's really thinking about, and it's done very smartly.
We have a call-in show this Monday that fits in with this in a lot of ways because that show on Monday is going to be on having nerve.
Mm.
And so it's a little bit the same thing. It's being brave enough to do something, whether it's, you know, forward motion or to stop something, you know, so in line with this.
Yeah,
so
I'm going to keep reading it. So it's called Mastering the Art of Quitting. And see, what's cute about it is if you see the jacket, it's like you wrote quitting in different graphics, but then crossed it out twice until you came to the
To the right one.
To the one that you leave. And it's Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work by Peg Streep and Alan Bernstein.
And we have tons of books on the tables next to us to tell you about. We have room for you at 203-776-WNPR. If you'd like to tell us about a book you love, maybe you've read it with a book club, we'd love to hear so we can spread the word of a good read here on The Book Show. And we'll be right back. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner. We have value wines posted there, easy cocktails, and much more. Our guests, the shows, the books we talk about, click on programs at WNPR.org. for the Faith Middleton Show. I'm with my book buddies, Roxanne Cody, Rose Criello, and Lee Jacobus. Rose, what do you have?
Faith, in keeping with my theme of books that change me, I recently read Thich Nhat Hanh's book, and Han is spelled H-A-N-H, and this is his book on reconciliation. And he takes us through the suffering that we have. And look, let me preface this talk by saying that this is not a self-help book. And I think sometimes those self-help books exploit more than they do help us. But this is an amazing book, this book called Reconciliation, because he really helped me to understand that any suffering I might have, any anger, all those issues that I have that I'm not comfortable with, that the only way to resolve them is through, he's a Buddhist, is through mindfulness. And through that, at the heart of that is empathy. And he really reminded me on a visceral level that, to quote Atticus Finch, once we come out of ourselves and walk in the skin of others, not just the shoes, but the skin, that it becomes difficult to take anything that anybody is saying about us personally. So at the heart, it's Karen Armstrong's 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. And I don't want to make this sound all touchy-feely. It's bigger than that. It's better than that. And it's an amazing book. I read it in one sitting.
Well, there is a Mark Epstein has been on the show, and he's done this book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. Mm-hmm. And his idea is that the only way to release something is to go through the thing. Mm-hmm. And rather than, you know, have a complete lack of identification with it, but at least to acknowledge that it's there and to feel it, and then perhaps to move on from there as you were walking through the feeling. So is that what Han is saying?
That's exactly what he's saying. Well, you know, I've been reading Buddhist literature for over a dozen years now, and the Buddhists would say that we don't turn away from your pain. Walk into your suffering. Try to get comfortable in the middle of the river when you're foundering out there. But he is saying to go back in time, to face those moments, healing the inner child, to face those moments that have been very painful for us. But he's saying not just face them or to go through the suffering and the anger again, but to put ourselves in the victimizer's skin. I was going to say shoe, and I changed it to skin. And that once you understand, he would say, that for that person to hurt you, that person is hurting too. And I want to not make it sound so cliche-ish. It's very real. That once you can really understand that anybody leveling blows at you is equally suffering, it takes away the currency of that blow.
Uh-huh. And it doesn't mean the person's any less dangerous.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Anyway, I get it. The name of the book is Reconciliation by Thich Nhat Hanh, and his last name is spelled H-A-N-H.
Yeah, just that tricky spelling I always forget. Thank you, Rose. We're going to go now to Sarah, who has called in at 203-776-WNPR to tell us, I'm sure, about a book she loves. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi. I'm reading a book called The Fault in Our Stars by John Green.
Yeah, and how do you like it?
You know what? I really am enjoying it. And, you know, my children read it, and they're teenagers, and they were shocked that I was reading it. And I think it's a book that's really sad because there's children with cancer, and, you know, they're some of them are facing death, but it's funny in parts. It's the way they deal with it from a child's point of view, how they deal with an illness, and it's about love, and it's about hope. And I haven't gotten to the end. One of my daughters was crying the other night getting to the end of it. But I really am enjoying it. Have you read it?
No.
I have.
You have?
Yeah. I think it's genius. I think that, and you know, he's become sort of the leader of this whole movement of different kinds of, you know, it's even a little younger than young adult, but taking sad things and teaching compassion in a way that these young adults and older kids are really connecting to. I think it has created an entire world. Penguin published it, and I just think he did a genius job. And it's also another example of young adult books, which I think we've talked about, that resonate with – oh, actually, that was our assignment. Young adults that resonate with adults.
Yeah, that's so true. Okay, thank you so much for calling in, Sue.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. 203-776-9677. Lija Kobus.
Well, I just finished Andre Dubas III's Dirty Love, his current book. And, of course, there is a lot of sex in Dirty Love, just in case you wonder. you may learn a few things. One never knows. This is actually four short novellas. They are all kind of related to one another because they're in the same place. Dubas lives up in Newbury, Massachusetts, and he's invented a town that's very similar to that. The last of these is the best. It's called Dirty Love. And it is a deeply touching story about a young girl, 17, who is caught by her boyfriends doing a sex act that gets on the internet, visually on the internet. So she is, in a sense, a distressed person, drops out of school, feels she – and her family gives her no help at all. They treat her like a whore, and they're just mean and vicious to her. She leaves home, and she goes and lives with her great uncle, who was in his 80s. And he was a former drunk, has reformed. He was a former teacher. He's retired. And the two of them live together, taking each other just simply as they are, without any sense of blame, judgment, or whatever. And he does his best to try to help her get her GED, and she's not entirely sure she wants to. The actual story itself is very touching and very simple, and I'm not going to tell you anything more about it except to say that the affection between these two creatures is really quite touching. They're as distant as you can expect them to be at age 17 and at age 83 or 4, but nonetheless, they see each other as they are, and they respect each other as they are, and they try to make a family out of it. It's really a very touching thing. And again, it is a question of love, dirty or otherwise, dirty and otherwise. And that's the thing that makes it so remarkable. Dubas is a remarkable writer. You know, he did The House of Sand and Fog. He's famous for that. But this has the light touch all the way through. No pyrotechnics as a writer. You know what Elmore Leonard says, if it sounds like writing, get rid of it. Well, that's how he approaches it. It's a very straightforward, beautifully told story, and I recommend it highly. So it's Andre Dubas III's Dirty Love, his current book, just out.
Thank you, Lee. 203-776-WNPR. Here on the book show, we're trying to give you as many good reads as we can. I am so, I just love this book so much. This is called The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects by Richard Curran. And he is the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian. And for decades, he's been this driving force in this effort to put together this giant team of scholars and curators, and for them to look at all the objects in all the Smithsonian museums and to come up with this 101 objects that would tell the story of America, our culture, our ways, how we celebrate ourselves, our traditions, our values through these objects. And this is one of these books where it's such a great gift to someone and to yourself, because I could not put this down. I kept going from page to page where I thought, oh, my God, look. And the story of the Star-Spangled Banner, I was practically in tears over this story of how many people. The Hope Diamond is in here. Harry Winston donated it to the Smithsonian because he said all these other countries have jewels. He just sent it over in the mail, $142 insurance, and it arrived, you know, in front of cameras. There's a picture in here of it, and it tells the story of why he did that. There's Julia Child's kitchen that they talk about, the spacesuit from the first walk on the moon, the hat of Abraham Lincoln, Audubon's stuff, a lot of, you know, they get into pop culture stuff.
I'm in love with that book.
Are you?
I love it. It was one of my favorite books during the holiday season. It's the kind of book you want to leave around your house.
Oh, yeah.
So just pick it up and read a piece about it, because you learn history in an entirely different way.
Yeah. You know, I always say that if I could go to school, I'd walk over to Yale, which is right here. Our studio's kind of in the middle of Yale. We would walk over to Yale. I would, and sit down and take an American Studies course, because that's the course that goes through everything. It goes through history and English and pop culture and blends it all together to tell you, to look at a culture in all these different ways. That's a dream to me. That's really what this book is. I feel like I've taken an American Studies course. It's just very cool. Paintings, photographs, planes. Oh, it's really terrific. And I am learning so much about history. So it's called the... And Richard Curran, by the way, K-U-R-I-N, the way he writes in here is so personal. You know, he'll say, you know, I cried when I read such and such, or, you know, this other thing has brought so many people to tears when they see it. He's very personal, each of these essays and these stories. So it's The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects by Richard Curran, K-U-R-I-N. Ernie, Faith Middleton, welcome to the book show.
Hi, good afternoon, Faith.
Hi.
You know, we've had a new book just come out by Robert Gates called Duty.
Yes.
Which he tears into the administration.
Yes, he does. Yep, he comes after Joe Biden, President Obama, lots of people.
Yes, he does. And it took me back to a book I had read several years ago called The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill by Ron Susskind. Paul O'Neill was Secretary of Treasury under President mm-hmm. Bush. And he had to quit after he couldn't get along with the president on some of his issues, and he wrote this book, which is very revealing about the Bush White House. I want to contrast it a little bit with the recent book that we just talked about. What this book is about is one. I'll just read you one excerpt from it. The package of tax proposals, led by the 50% cut in the individual tax on dividends, had been all but buried before the midterm election in 2004, or 2006, I should say. It came up infrequently and always in the past tense. What George Bush wanted to do but couldn't afford. But after the Republicans won the midterm, O'Neill could sense a change in the White House, a smugness, a stiffness, Now Cheney brought up the tax proposal again, how they would provide the stimulus. Cheney was the vice president. O'Neill jumped in, arguing sharply how the government was moving towards a fiscal crisis and what rising deficits would mean to our economic soundness. Cheney cut him off. Reagan provided deficits don't matter, Cheney said. O'Neill shook his head, hardly believing that Cheney, whom he and Greenspan had known since Dick was a kid, could say such a thing. He was speechless. Cheney moved on to fill the void. We won the midterm, didn't we? Let's get that tax cut. Well, we know that the tax cut went through on dividends, cut the tax on dividends by 50%, and we're seeing now, not of course due just to that, but the big gap between the wealthy and the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So well, I recommend this book as a contrast to Bob. Maybe that reading that one in Bob Gates' new book would be very informative.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it very much. That book has just come out, and as our caller has said, causing so much controversy. And very, very interesting. I haven't read the book, but I certainly have read lots and lots of articles about what's being said. And Gates, interestingly, seemed to be a big fan of Hillary Clinton's. And I thought, ooh, this is really going to be interesting.
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. We have lots more books to talk about here on the book show. And Isabel Allende, Sue Monk Kidd's new book, The Invention of Wings. Lots more coming your way. Don't go away. I'm Faith Middleton. I'd like to thank our talented crew, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol, and production assistants today from Marion Roy. I'm with my book buddies Roxanne Cody, Lee Jacobus, and Rose Quiello. We look forward to hearing from you about a great book, 203-776-9677. I have an invitation for you because this is a way to say I love you to someone and enjoy fantastic food and wine in a beautiful setting. I hope you will join me the week of Valentine's Day for my 5th annual Heart-to-Heart Champagne Dinner Dance, February 12th at the Society Room in downtown Hartford, featuring a celebrated team of chefs working to make it a magical night for you, and wines from the gorgeous Frederick Wildman portfolio with music from Alex Nakamovsky, his vocalists and orchestra, special effects lighting from Audio Media Solutions. It's quite snazzy looking in there when the lighting artists come in. And the dress is festive, meaning whatever you would like to wear. Tickets are $90 per person to benefit WNPR and the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. There's plenty of parking at the site. And our team of talented chefs includes David Sellers of Max Fish, Jeffrey Lazat on 20, Brad Stabinski, Chamard Vineyards, Jason Sobozinski of Casey's, Jeffrey Crawford of Jordan Caterer, Stefan Drago of Bell Terrace, and Christopher Prosperi of Metro Beast. And the menu is, I can tell you, mouthwatering. And this event sells out every time, so of course seating is limited. Special thanks to UConn Health Center's Pat and Jim Calhoun Cardiology Center and Fiddleheads. I cannot wait to see you there February 12th. Go to WNPRHeartToHeart.org. That's WNPRHeartToHeart.org to be part of my Food Schmooze signature event. You will see the box there, and you just click on that. You get all your instructions. Okay, Brian, Faith Middleton, welcome to the book show.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi, Brian.
I don't know if anybody's heard of this book. It's called The Wrecking Crew by Kent Hartman.
No, go ahead. Tell us about it.
Okay, there is another book with the same title, by the way, so this one is by Kent Hartman. The Wrecking Crew is a phrase that's been used for some decades. It was a group of, say, roughly 20 or 30 musicians. They were called session players. They would play on all those records that were made in L.A. back from, let's say, the 60s or early 70s. So all this oldie stuff you're hearing on the radio, if it's music from the 60s, if it's out of L.A. as opposed to London or whatever, then that's who you're hearing, is all these drummer and guitarist and so on. And most of them didn't become famous in their own right. They just stayed in that group, and so most Americans have never heard of them. And one guy they mention is this guy, Hal Blaine. He's one of the greatest drummers who ever lived. He comes from Hartford. In fact, he was at the Circus Fire.
Oh.
Now, I guess, in his 80s.
Huh.
And this guy, here's an example. This guy, most Americans, even though they listened to that music, they couldn't name him for Beans. They don't know the name Hal Blaine. This guy is such a great drummer. To this day, when Bruce Springsteen wants to mention something that a particular drummer did that was especially great, that's the name he uses as a comparison. He said, this guy did something that was so great that it was like Hal Blaine. Okay, so that's an example of how
obscure
these guys, even though there's the contrast between how obscure most of them have stayed and how great, how accomplished they were. And it's,
well,
you know, in other words, it's not just a coincidence that so many great records came out of L.A. during that period, and it's largely because of these session players. These,
well, yes. So important. Hey, do you, so what happened to Hal Blaine?
Hal Blaine, he was at the Circus Fire. I guess he got out pretty easily because he just went right under the bottom of the...
No, I mean, is he? Did he die or is he alive?
To my knowledge, he's still around. I figure he would be somewhere around 84. He certainly hasn't played on any records in many, many years. But
Hal Blaine, I would like to find you.
Yeah.
I really would.
Yeah, but there's great, you know, the guy tells great anecdotes in here about, he breaks the book down into different chapters about various famous songs, like there's one on classical gas. There's even one on a Sinatra song, because these guys played at a recording session for Strangers in the Night. And the funny thing was, Sinatra thought that the guitar player was gay, because the guitar, this is in the 60s, Sinatra was not very politically correct by today's standards.
He was kind of
looking at, you know, the guitar player staring at Sinatra. The guitar player is just a young guy who's just so thrilled that he's playing on a Sinatra record. He can't believe his good luck. And so after the session, Sinatra goes over to one of the suits and says, hey, that guitar player, you know, he's gay, what are you staring at me? It turned out that it was all very innocent. And the funny thing was, and I don't say that to put down Sinatra. You have to understand this was the 60s. It wasn't a recent episode. The funny thing was, when you do find out the name of the guitar player, it ends up being even funnier. The guy's name was Glenn Campbell.
That's very, very interesting.
Can you imagine a gay rhinestone cowboy? I mean, that was just...
Yeah, actually, I can't. Okay, thank you. Hey,
and I have to say, it's surprising that I haven't heard a lot about this book. It's
Brian.
Been like over a year, and there's so many people of my generation who are into the music of the 60s, everything from the Beach Boys to
Brian.
You know, the Fifth Dimension.
Hey,
so
Brian?
I don't know a lot about this book.
I want you to say the name of the book again, and I wanted to also let you know that that the drummer is alive, and he's now age 84.
Yes, that's exactly about what I was.
Okay, so name of the book for us one more time.
The book is called The Wrecking Crew, and there is another book with the same title. So this one is by Kent Hartman, H-A-R-T-M-A-N.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Let's see, who's up? Whose turn is it? Is it mine? Oh, okay. I think I have picked this book up, and I'm just finishing column to Beans' book. And the next one, because I loved when Sue Monk Kidd did Secret Life of Bees. I loved that book so much. And so she has a book out called The Invention of Wings. And it is described this way, that Hetty Handful Grimke is an urban slave. This is early 19th century Charleston. And this young person is just yearning for a life beyond the suffocating walls that enclose her in this wealthy household. And, these wealthy householders have a daughter, and her name is Sarah. And she has a pretty ravenous intellect, and she's pretty mutinous. And she's one of these kids who just knows she's meant to do something big in life. And so you know what's going to happen, that these two are going to get together and something quite wild is going to happen. So I cannot, I really look forward to reading this. So I'm letting you know that Sue Monk Kidd's novel is out, The Invention of Wings. Has anybody in the room read this already?
No, not yet. Staff at the bookstore has, and they are insanely enthusiastic about it.
Oh,
love it. Love
I'm
it.
So happy to hear that.
Love it.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. 203-776-WNPR if you've got a book that you love, whether it's a classic or, you know, fairly new. Any kind of book that you love, we'd love to hear about it. Roxanne?
So before I mention the book I really want to talk about, that book reminded me of the movie that's out, 12 Years a Slave, is actually based on that man's diaries. And I'm reading those diaries now, and they are remarkable. So I don't know if I can bear watching the movie, but reading about it gives you another level of understanding. And plus, it so puts you in his shoes. I mean, these are his words. So his name is Solomon Northrup, and it's 12 Years a Slave, and it's his diary that the movie's based on.
Great. Okay, so now I want to ask you about a couple of other movies to see, are there books out that preceded these? The movie Her, which is about a man who falls in love with an operating system, a computer operating system. Is there a book that goes with that
Not
movie?
Not that I know.
Okay.
I don't
now,
know.
Now, my favorite movie out there, I did like Her a lot, but my favorite movie out there right now, there are some I haven't seen, is American Hustle. It is so fabulous. The acting, the writing, so ferocious. It's just really amazing. Do you know, is there a book?
It's
American
only
Hustle?
Loosely based on all the Abscam
yes, okay,
books, but
so
there
no.
isn't one.
Okay.
No, that came, that comes from that genius's brain.
Oh,
what's his name?
Spike Jones.
Is he the guy who wrote it?
Oh, no, Spike
it's
Jones.
It's not Spike Jones.
It's Spike Jones did Her. I'm sorry.
Right, right.
American
Because he did Silver Lining.
Is David O. Russell.
Right. Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So,
Silver Lining Playbook.
So the book I really want to talk about, and then we can come back and talk about American Hustle, because I liked it, but I don't know that it's as genius as I think everybody's saying.
Okay.
All right.
So go ahead. What's your book?
It's called My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel by Ari Shavit. And here's what's brilliant about this book. There are not many books about the Middle East since the a book by David Frumkin called A Peace to End All Peace that is pragmatic and even-handed about the conflict in Israel and what the state of Israel and Zionism is about. And what he does is, this is language that I think is gets it, what he does exactly right. He says, there is love in my promised land, but there is no propaganda. And so when you think of, you know, now Kerry's over there trying to do it, the other thing he says is a dreamer with an addiction to reality. And he holds out for affirmation without illusion. So what he does is take this whole notion of Jews creating a place where they could be safe after they've had so many years of not being safe, with the dream that they had of creating this country that was different and better than something that had existed, with the reality now of the Palestinian conflict, and you know the Palestinians are responsible, the Israelis are responsible, and how do you tease out what each thing is really about? And I think what he does in this book, for somebody who wants to understand the ingredients, you know, because when you read either one who's got an agenda, you're like, wow, that's kind of crazy. That's correct. And then you read, and neither one are necessarily totally factually right. So I think what he does, he's an Israeli. I think what he does is really put us a step towards understanding the whole of what is contributing to this experiment, compromise, failure, success. I mean, the whole bailiwick of it.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And he's a great writer. It's called My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel by Ari Shavit, S-H-A-V-I-T.
My Promised Land. Jackie Faith Middleton and the gang here on The Book Show. Go ahead, Jackie. Oh, I'm sorry, Jackie. We kept you waiting, and Jackie just hung up. I apologize for that. 203-776-WNPR. Rose, what do you have?
Faith, this book might have been discussed here already, but I wanted to talk about it, and it's Catherine Boo's Behind the Beautiful Forevers, because we're doing a book club on it, and this is another book that has changed me. And this book describes the life of Abdul, of a few months in his life living in Anawandi, which is right beneath the Mumbai airport in India. And he's been unfairly accused of a crime. But this takes us into the poverty of these slum dwellers in this Anawandi. And these characters, this is a work of nonfiction. What makes this book so extraordinary to me is here we have these children living on insects, rodents. The poverty is indescribable. It moved me to tears at times. Is that within these characters is this unbelievable sense of hope. This book is a real testimony to the human spirit. And what makes it also so distressful for me is that it's going on today. This is happening right now in a country where Catherine Boo says the poor blame the government who have more, they blame the poor. And that's kind of, I was reflecting on that last night, and that's kind of what we do here. The poor blame the government, and those of us who are not so poor, we blame the poor. And I have to tell you, this is one of my unforgettable books of the year, Behind the Beautiful Forevers. And may I just quickly add that the title comes from a billboard sign at the airport that advertises Italian tile that is beautiful forever.
Mm. Okay.
Catherine Boo, B-O-O.
Lee, I've got one, and I know you have one, so can you do it? You want to?
Why don't you do it?
Okay. So this is also an announcement that this book is out. Many fans for Isabel Allende, and she has done something very interesting and has written a thriller, very unusual for her. It's called Ripper, and it's set in San Francisco today. And she did Maya's Notebook. Her books have sold 60 million copies in 29 languages. I mean, it's just really extraordinary. So this is very interesting. And I started reading a few pages because I couldn't resist when I was at my desk. And I like the feel of the
She's
writing.
She's a genius.
She
I
really,
love her.
Really, I loved it. And I thought, oh, a thriller from Isabel Allende? This is going to be something. So I wanted to let people know that this is out. It is a novel called Ripper. They're not calling it a thriller on the jacket, but that's what all the promo. It is a thriller.
Well, she's just such an extraordinary writer. I mean, her writing about her daughter, for example, is among the most wonderful books that I've read in years. I mean, I really think a great deal of her.
Paula? Yeah.
Have we got John? Go ahead. John, quickly, if you can.
Yes. I just wanted to say I got a Christmas gift of a book called Van Gogh's Letters.
Van Gogh's Letters, yeah.
And I apologize, I'm on a hands-free right now, but I don't know the author, but it basically follows Van Gogh's paintings and letters to his brother, Theo. And it's just an absolutely amazing book to get inside the mind of an incredible artist and where he was thinking and what he thought about his own paintings. It's just a wonderful gift I got.
Okay, So Van Gogh's Letters by H. Anna Smith.
I believe that's it, yes.
Yes, that's it. Okay. Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So interesting as always that here on the book show we see a kind of range, a breadth of stories and genres. I love that about the book show. I just wanted to say the best-selling novelist ever is Agatha Christie.
Yes, right.
Her books have sold 2 billion copies in 45 languages. How about that?
Gosh.
Thank you so much for listening. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find everything online, including recipes, great things for dinner, value wines at our website. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.